Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, you're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to start off the program this week by saying a few words about the Abraham Accords, which Israel made with the several Arab Muslim nations. 6 months into the Gaza war, that's where we are now, and world opinion has steadily hardened and turned against Israel. The appeals for a pause in fighting have grown even more strident, culminating in a resolution passed on March 25th by the UN Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire. The United States didn't vote on that, and since then there's also been a tragedy where a number of workers who were bringing food to people in Gaza were killed, apparently by accident, by the Israeli army, and the American government has spoken out against what happened. Now, this resolution calling for the stopping of the war, the resolution passed by the UN, is also demanding the immediate and unconditional release of all the hostages held by a hostage. However, it didn't link the ceasefire call to the hostage release. In short, the UN is instructing Israel to stop fighting Hamas, giving it time to revive and regroup, and leaving it free to continue bombarding Israel with rockets and drones. That's what the UN did. UN Council members knew, of course, that demanding Hamas release of all the hostages was simply virtue signaling, so it is quite unenforceable. Hamas is a terrorist organization unbeholden to the United Nations or to anyone else. We're 6 months into the conflict. It's cost thousands of lives. Polls of Arab opinion indicate overwhelming support of Hamas. Regardless of this, Abraham Accord regimes convinced that the benefits from the accords with Israel override other considerations, are sidelining public opinion. It was back in 2020-2021, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan signed the deals collectively known as the Abraham Accords. Sudan is a special case. For nearly a year, Sudan has been torn asunder by a ferocious civil war and is suffering one of the worst humanitarian crises in history. In the case of the United Arab Emirates, according to a March report in the New York Times, Emirati officials said they have no intention of cutting ties with Israel. On the contrary, in a document addressed to the New York Times, the Emirati government of the UAE highlighted how its officials have used their relationship with Israel to facilitate the entry of humanitarian aid for the Gazans, as well as the medical treatment of injured Gazans taken to the Emirates. According to the government there, the UAE believes that diplomatic and political communications are important in difficult times such as these. In February, the Nir Barkat, our economic minister here in Israel, became the first Israeli minister to visit the Emirates since October 7th. He attended the World Trade Organization's conference in Abu Dhabi. Also, the editor of the Jerusalem Post went to Abu Dhabi. And minister was seen shaking hands and chatting with Saudi Arabia's Commerce Minister. And in an interview, he said he was very optimistic after meeting with Emirati officials. He said there's a bit of sensitivity while the war is still happening, but the two countries have aligned interests, and Abraham Accords are extremely strategic for all of us. The Foreign Policy Research Institute published an article. And it records a pronouncement by the lower house of Bahrain's parliament on November 2nd, declaring the halting of economic ties with Israel and return of ambassadors on both sides in support of the Palestinian cause and legitimate rights to the people, brotherly Palestinian people. Now, this was no more than a gesture, because the Bahrain parliament has no locus at all in the state's foreign policy. The parliamentary initiative has no impact on formal diplomatic relations between Israel and Bahrain. So even though the parliament made a statement of that, it really has no effect. The government there does what it wants. However, the question is, what will be the future relations? The reemergence of the Palestinian issue is central to the regional and to the international agenda. May have an impact, but it's highly uncertain, because we have developed economic and political relations with their country, and they pay lip service to the Palestinians. The question is, how serious are they? That's as far as the UAE is concerned. As regards Morocco, the news medium Al Jazeera, which is based, reports that despite issuing public anger in the country of Israel-Hamas conflict, the normalization deal between Morocco and Israel will likely hold. Since early October, thousands of Moroccans have marched in the capital, Rabat, with Palestinian flags and slogans calling, among other things, for an end to the Moroccan government normalization with Israel. However, high political considerations, which are really run by the King of Morocco himself, pretty much outweigh what popular murmurings. The carrot offered to Morocco by the Trump administration as an inducement to sign up to the accords, what did the U.S. promise? U.S. recognition of Morocco's claim to the disputed territory of Western Sahara. This is something Morocco really wanted bad, and it represents a major boost in its long dispute with Algeria over claims to that territory. Moreover, the military advantage Morocco has been able to acquire through deals with Israel is apparently substantial. It would be difficult for Morocco to walk away from this partnership with Israel. So in general, the analysts have said the effect of the Gaza conflict will be slow rather than halt Israel's continued normalization with Abraham Accord states like UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia apparently has some secret relations with Israel and remains in the wings, waiting a moment just to sign up. Who knows? It's hard to say. So the bottom line is, the Abraham Accords will probably survive the war we now have in Gaza. I'd like to say a few words about the so-called two-state solution. The two-state solution calls for the creation of a sovereign Palestinian state in Judea, Samaria, and eastern Jerusalem, as well as the Gaza Strip. However, we know it would be controlled by terrorist organization, so promoting it is pretty much a recipe for disaster. This solution wouldn't solve the issue of self-determination for Palestinians, and it would pretty much empower Israel's enemies. Also, it makes no sense, since a Palestinian state already exists. It's called the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, which was created in the eastern area of the British Mandate. Two-thirds of the population of Jordan, two-thirds, consider themselves Palestinians. A new two-state solution would be really Israel and Jordan / Palestine. It would save lives and offer Palestinians the opportunity of becoming productive instead of living under the control of terrorist organization. The real two-state solution would be to include Palestine in Jordan. And a plan like that would not require transferring all Arab Palestinians from the West Bank to Jordan, but it would offer them a choice. Those who want to live under Israeli sovereignty and abide by Israel's laws should be allowed to remain, either as citizens or residents. Those who don't want to would have to move to Jordan or any other country. The PLO, Hamas, and other terrorist organizations would also no longer be tolerated or accepted. All the UNRWA UNRWA facilities would be closed. International organizations would be required to accept Israeli sovereignty. Creating another Arab-Palestinian state ignores the reasons why Palestinian leaders have consistently rejected in the past. It would require four things for them to recognize Israel. First, they'd have to recognize Israel's right to exist, settling the issue of borders, ending terrorism, including support of terrorism, and ending demands for a right of return. There were Arabs who claimed to be either refugees from the war in 1948 or their descendants. They have like great-grandchildren already of people who were kicked out in 1948. And although Israel accepted the concept of Palestinian autonomy back in the Oslo Accords in 1993, also in the Camp Davis Accords in 2000, and they took Jews out of the Gaza Strip in 2005, and they made agreements to Palestinian Authority and Hamas, the Jewish state cannot be accepted, jeopardize its vital security interests by empowering its enemies. That is a fact. There is no doubt that in improving relations with Arab countries by these Abraham Accords has a regional potential for peace that would really be undermined by a new Palestinian state in the West Bank. Hamas's attack on October 7th, the ongoing war in Gaza, and the threat of an expanding war with Iran-backed Hezbollah in the north have created a new awareness of the threats to Israel's existence. This cannot be underestimated or ignored. We are threatened on the north, and we are already fighting in the south. For a while, the Oslo Accords removed the Jordanian option the range of possible alternatives. Instead, Yasser Arafat, the PLO, and the Palestinian Authority were installed as the rulers of what was intended to be a second Palestinian state west of the Jordan River. That was a peace plan. It failed, not only because of Palestinian terrorism, but because of continued opposition to Israel's existence. Moreover, Arab-Palestinian terrorist organizations never intended to achieve peace. Their goal was, and still is, to destroy Israel. Rather than understand why the Oslo Accords and what became known as the two-state solution failed, and reconsider alternatives, the planners and supporters continue to cling to this fantasy, coaxing and bribing Palestinians to make a deal always fails, because that would mean ending the conflict and accepting Israel, and that would be a betrayal of what Palestinianism is all about. Establishing such a Palestinian state in the West Bank would lead to increased destabilization, increase the chances for violence not against Israel, but between competing terrorist entities and gangs and militias, which is the case right now. Therefore, I think an idea recognizing Jordan as Palestinian state while maintaining its status as a monarchy reflects the national identity of a majority of the Jordanian population, which is Palestinian. By the way, the Queen of Jordan, Queen Rania, is considered to be a Palestinian via her parents. Palestinians are a growing segment of Jordan's political life and its parliament. So that country is viable with a relatively stable economic and political structure. And on top of that, it has vast areas of unused lands. However, it lacks sufficient people and water. This Jordan becoming part of Palestine, or Palestine becoming part of Jordan, can become an oasis. It needs water, which will allow it to extend its populations eastward. Utilizing abundant water sources in Turkey or the Caspian Sea, which, by the way, the Caspian Sea is the largest body of fresh water in the world, using this in Jordan would enable it to provide agricultural products, develop business and industrial centers, and create regional stability. Another population source to help develop the huge and basically empty eastern part of Jordan, besides its current citizen, would be those Palestinians who would either come from the West Bank voluntarily or be sent there because they chose not to live under Israeli sovereignty or to abide by the laws of the Jewish state. So this would include any Palestinians, wherever they live, whether in Gaza or Lebanon or Syria, as well as our residents of Israel proper. All of them would rightly be citizens of a newly realized Jordanian-Palestinian state, the Hashemite Kingdom of Palestine. The possibility that Jordan could become an economic trade center was originally given a boost when Israel proposed a rail link between Jordan and Haifa, which would connect it to the European markets, to the Gulf states, and Saudi Arabia. There was a recently built rail line between Haifa and Beit Shan, which I took a trip there last year, and it's really the beginning of this kind of plan. Jordan is a strategic partner of Israel and hopefully will continue to be. Jordanians, however, have responsibility to Arab Palestinians. Israel should not be expected to bear the burden of providing them with a national homeland. Recognizing Jordan as a Palestinian state is a national interest of both countries. It will bring peace and prosperity to them, ensure their security and stability, and the entire region. A Jordanian-Israeli confederation would replace failure and despair with opportunity and hope. It would inspire creativity, cooperation, and freedom. So the idea of turning Jordan into a Palestinian state, it may not be a bad idea. I'll be back after the break.
Be smart. Listen to Israel News Talk Radio in the background while you work and get the latest news and commentary from Israel. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. Thanks again for listening. It's interesting. When I lived in Philadelphia, I attended school at the University of Pennsylvania, and I also attended school at Drexel Institute of Technology. And I just wanted to mention, I saw an article in the paper that the Raymond G. Perlman Center for Jewish Life at Drexel University in Philadelphia has been vandalized. School President John Fry revealed in a statement condemning the incident. According to the school president, the vandals removed large channel letters spelling out Perlman's name from a brick structure bearing the building's name. This is a Jewish center. The disturbing act, which occurred amid an explosion of anti-Semitic hate crimes across the U.S., was filmed by surveillance cameras, but the culprits cannot be identified because they wore masks. It bears repeating that vandalizing centers of Jewish life and learning, defacing property with anti-Semitic graffiti, or ripping mezuzot off doorposts and residence halls does not constitute any legitimate form of protest, said the president of Drexel University. So what we're having now all over the United States, even in or especially perhaps in universities, is anti-Semitic attacks. Having said that, I want to go on to something else. The unintentional killing of 7 aid workers in the World Central Kitchen last week in Gaza was a horrible tragedy. It's been spoken about all over the world continually since then. However, it's one of the innumerable tragedies of the war in Gaza. The war was triggered by Hamas' invasion of Israel. It murdered 1,200 people and it kidnapped 240 hostages. Israel is not responsible for this war. And accidents happen in times of war. The tragedies of this war include the death of dozens of Gazans and a swarm toward an aid convoy in February. They were killed by other members of the underground there because they were trying to get food. There was an accidental killing by the Israeli army of three hostages seeking to escape in December. Three Israelis were killed because they were mistaken by the army. The friendly fire or military accidents have led to some 15% of all Israeli army fatalities in Gaza, and the unintentional killing of Palestinian civilians who are used by Hamas as human shields. They're caught in the crossfire. The chief of staff of the Israeli army, Halevi, was correct to quickly apologize for the deaths of these workers of the World Central Kitchen. And he called the firing at the aid convoy a grave mistake caused by misidentification. And he pledged a swift investigation into what went wrong and established a new humanitarian command center under Israel's Army's Southern Command to better coordinate between the work of the various aid organizations inside Gaza and the Israeli army. Also, our Prime Minister Netanyahu said these things happen in war. Although considering the attention this incident has generated around the world, and these incidents do happen in less than sterile conditions of battle. They have happened in every country that has ever engaged in warfare. I'll give several examples. During the war in Afghanistan, the United States, in July 2008, accidentally struck a wedding party, believing that those in the party to be insurgents. 47 civilians, including the bride, were killed. In November of 2008, another strike at a wedding in Afghanistan killed 37. They were killed by Americans. These were not isolated incidents. As recently as 2021, a U.S. drone shot and killed 10 civilians in Kabul. They killed an aid worker and 7 children, mistakenly believing they were terrorists. As of May 2023, according to Brown University's Institute of International and Public Affairs, an estimated 432,903 were killed in America's post-9/11 wars. They were killed in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, and Pakistan. That's almost 443,903 civilians killed by America. says almost 500,000. It is with those numbers in mind that the U.S. President Joe Biden's chastising of Israel last week over the killing of the World Central Kitchen workers was simply disingenuous. Biden said that this is not a standalone incident. This conflict has been one of the worst in recent memory in terms of how many aid workers have been killed. Israel has also not done enough to protect civilians. It's interesting, by the way, I think that President Biden, what he's doing, he's worried about getting the vote in Illinois, and Michigan has a lot of Muslims, so now he's all of a sudden he's chastising Israel. An army has to avoid civilian casualties. However, there are two main problems with the statement made by President Biden. First, saying that Israel has not done enough to protect aid workers and other civilians is simply untrue and reckless. It gives fuel to those who spread lies about Israel. That's one thing. The second thing is that the president did not once in his statement acknowledge Hamas's responsibility for the entire situation. It is Hamas who attacked Israel. It is Hamas who is prolonging this war by not releasing the hostages and surrendering. Hamas terrorists are the ones who both hid behind and disguised themselves as journalists and ambulance drivers and humanitarian workers, therefore placing these real people who act in these real capacities at risk, since Hamas is pretending to be them also. The all civilian casualties in Gaza, even those mistakenly caused by Israel, must be laid at Hamas's doorstep. Had Hamas not attacked on October 7th, or had released the hostages shortly thereafter and surrendered, none of this would be happening. Now, obviously, Israel will investigate and learn the lessons of the tragedy, because this is something Israel always does. It's not need to be prodded to do so by others. What Israel does need, however, is for the international community to rein in its hypocrisy, stop treating battle zones as crime scenes, something that is inexplicably seemingly does when the Jewish state involved. Battle zones are not crime scenes. And there are war zones. A war zone, unfortunately, innocent people get killed. These are the facts of life. And we do not have the President of the United States lecturing us. Obviously, his lecturing us is for reasons of politics. And this is an election year in the United States, and he wants to make sure to get the Muslim vote in those states where there are a lot of Muslims. But he shouldn't do it at Israel's expense. There's no doubt that Israel will be grateful for Joe Biden, the U.S. president, for the support that he showed the country since the October 7th massacre. He stood by the country in its darkest hour. He warned Iran and its proxy Hezbollah not to take advantage of the situation, not to open other fronts against Israel. He sent a U.S. aircraft carrier strike force to the region to back up those warnings. So obviously Israel will be grateful for the way the Biden administration immediately launched an arms airlift to Israel, making good on its promise to ensure that Israel has the wherewithal to defend itself. So here, he also came here 11 days after Hamas's attack, the first U.S. president to visit Israel in time of war. And so now, Last week, he instructed the U.S. not to veto Security Council Resolution 2728, calling for an immediate ceasefire for Ramadan. This Ramadan is the Muslim holy month. So that's what he did. It didn't take long for the consequences of this action to be felt. Just hours after Hamas welcomed the resolution, the terrorist organization turned down the terms hammered out of weeks of negotiations for a ceasefire and hostage release. The refusal of the Security Council to even once, either through a resolution or a statement put out by its president, even once to condemn Hamas for what it did in October is absolutely staggering. That is especially true considering that the Security Council knows how to condemn terrorism when Israel is not on the receiving end. On March 22nd, one day after a terrorist attack in Moscow killed some 140 people, the Security Council issued a statement condemning in the strongest terms the cowardly terrorist attack. The Security Council also issued a similar statement on several days later when a suicide bomber in Pakistan killed five Chinese workers. And now, it's more than 170 days since terrorists murdered 1,200 people in Israel, kidnapped more than 240 hostages, raped women, burned babies, mutilated bodies, set fire to entire communities, and no statement has come condemning this from the UN Security Council. So the Hamas, of course, welcomed the UN resolution because it knows that the world will focus on the first part of the first clause in this non-binding resolution, pressing Israel hard to stop fighting. And the world will pay less attention to the second part of this UN resolution, a call for Hamas to release all the hostages. So why will the world not press the second part of that clause to release the hostages? Because it knows full well that Hamas operates way outside the bounds of civil society, and the terrorist organization is not going to heed any such call. They're sure that international pressure will focus Israel and force Israel to stop the war, enabling these terrorist groups to survive to fight. Security Council Resolution 2728 undoubtedly strengthened Hamas's feeling that the international community would deliver Israel into its hands. So, by the way, there is a tendency among many observers and most opposition politicians here to reject anything Netanyahu says, but often he says something that is correct, and we have to agree. To a lot of people around the world, Israel, in their minds, Israel is an instrument of white supremacy and imperialism. And regardless of the identity of the Prime Minister of Israel or who his government is made up of, the Jewish state would still be an illegitimate, racist, colonialist enterprise in the eyes of many people. That's unfortunate, really unfortunate. It's terrible that the world simply evaluates Israel differently than it does any other country. What's happening is, as the casualty figures in Gaza continue to rise, and Biden is getting pounded by progressive Democrats and Arab Americans for his support of Israel, Biden's tone and the tone of his administration have changed markedly in the last 2 months, and that has to do with Arab American voters. In Michigan, primarily, and when progressives, unenthused by the Biden campaign, harshly critical of Israel policy, and threatening either to vote for a third party candidate or to stay home on the election day. Now, it's Biden in the United States and Netanyahu here in Israel, and are both political animals. Both are using their disagreements for their own political purposes. But to say that this is all Netanyahu's fault and Israel's position in the world and in Washington would be sterling, even amid a war such as this, that someone else were calling the shots in Jerusalem, is simply not true. This doesn't mean that Netanyahu's handling of the relationship with the United States during this war has been flawless. He's made mistakes. But there is no doubt that things that are happening now that are primarily political on the part of Netanyahu, political on the part of Biden. And when politics gets involved, it sometimes covers reality. We have to win this war. We have to destroy Hamas, regardless of whether it's a American election or not, because we are in a war for survival. It's very interesting, by the way, when you think about it. It's very rare for a country to be in a war for its survival. For example, during the Second World War, there's no doubt that before America entered the Second World War, Britain was in a fight for its survival. The Nazis would have invaded Britain. The United States has never, to the best of my knowledge, been in a war for its survival, for its very survival. And that is the kind of war we are in now here in Israel. And therefore, we have to behave accordingly. We have to take that into account. I'll be back after the break.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. It's been nearly half a year since Hamas invaded Israel. We're still fighting the war to destroy Hamas. The nation has not yet turned from the battleground to an in-depth look at what went so terribly wrong. There have been television investigations and newspaper examinations, and both the Israeli army and the state controller are conducting investigations. But the truth of the matter is, a systematic look at how the Israeli army, the intelligence agencies, and the government were so completely blinded and clueless, it will probably take years to understand what happened. A state commission of inquiry will surely be established. It's not clear what will mark the end of the war point or when such a body would be set up. However, conventional wisdom holds that a committee is essential to rebuild trust in the state's institution, and that trust is vital. Israel critically needs to rebuild institutional trust. Much has been written of Israel's resilience. Israel has a tremendous, uncanny ability to take blows and bounce back, usually stronger than before. And this resilience has a number of different components. One of them is solidarity, because the people here have a unity of purpose, a shared vision, shared values, a common goal, and a willingness to set aside partisan individual interests for the common good, We saw that on October 7th. The country was in disarray before that came together within a moment. Some people feared that Israel had lost a sense of solidarity because there was a tremendous struggle, a debate over judicial overhaul, and it went on for about 9 months in 2023, and it was a bitter partisan divide. We had 5 elections in less than 4 years, but all this changed on October 7th. And another component of our unity, I think the component of our unity is not the faith we have in the Knesset. We don't have any faith in the Knesset, but the people of Israel have faith in themselves. That remains strong. It's interesting. There's an economic magazine called Economist, and about several weeks ago they featured a picture of an Israeli flag blowing in what appears to be a dusty wind with apparently destroyed buildings of Gaza in the background. And the two-word headline read, "Israel Alone," which I think is true. Israel's been more alone now, I think, than it has been in a long time. But the reason it can weather this isolation is belief in the justice of our cause and the justice of this war and the fact that we need to get together in order to survive. Also, I think Israelis are basically optimistic. They have hope. They have faith. That's pretty much, I think, ingrained in the Jewish psyche. And the late Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks talking about what the Jews will be saying on Passover this month. It says, "Now we are slaves. Next year we shall be free. Now we are here. Next year in the land of Israel." In other words, as bleak as things may look at the moment, Jews have belief and hope that things will get better. Jews are really very optimistic. And a final analysis, I think the people here, although they don't have faith in the government, the particular government that's ruling at a particular time, they do have faith in the army. They have faith in the police. They have faith in the judiciary. And I think people here believe that the institutions of the state are generally looking out for the good of the people and can be trusted to do their jobs. So this component, I guess, institutional trust, Israel has a problem with institutional trust. The institutional trust in Israel has been on decline for years. The Israel Democracy Institute takes polls every year. After October 7th and the total failure of the government institutions to prevent what happened, which really is a disaster of horrendous proportion, one could have been excused for believing that the faith in the institutions would be very low. Yet, 2 weeks ago, a poll was released by the Israel Democracy Institute and it was found that somewhat counterintuitively, this was not the case across the board. Now, the trust in the government is 28%. And the Knesset, the government and the Knesset was 28% for June and 24% for the government, 24% in the Knesset, both below 30%. They fell even lower in December to 23% and 19%. But, this is interesting, strength, trust in the IDF, the Israeli army, actually went up a percentage point from 85.5% in June to 86.5% in December. And the trust in the police, believe it or not, went up from 35% to 58%. 2 weeks ago, another poll was released by the Israel Democracy Institute, and it said that nearly half the public said that the chief of the general staff, Halevi, was doing a good or excellent job, while only 28% of the public said the same thing about Prime Minister Netanyahu. 57% said Netanyahu was doing a poor job managing the war. Taken together, these polls provide a very interesting snapshot of what's happening in Israel today, the status of Israeli society. Even though the army, the IDF, was caught completely unaware on October 7th, as was the government, the public still has trust in the IDF as an institution. So the question is, how do you explain this after this terrible tragedy in October? I think first, the Israeli army, although it was caught woefully unprepared, regrouped very quickly, drove the enemy back across the border within a couple of days, has performed impressively inside Gaza ever since, over the last 6 months. It was clear from the very beginning that the most efficient way for the army to regain the trust of the public would be to win the war against Hamas. The polling numbers reflect a public sense that the army is doing a good job. It's winning the war on the battlefield. However, this cannot be said at all for the government. It took a matter of days before the army returned to itself and the army began providing solutions. It took the government much longer. And the interim, the vacuum was filled by country citizens themselves who sprang into action immediately, rushed to the front, housed and clothed evacuees, and even fed soldiers. I myself, my wife and I, went every Tuesday for a long period of time to a place here in Jerusalem where they made tzitzit for soldiers, arba kamphas that are worn. Turns out that soldiers, even those who do not profess to be religious, somehow felt safer when they were wearing an arba kamphot, the four-cornered garment that Jews wear under their clothing with fringes attached. So the people responded immediately to the crisis. In addition, while the army is winning battles in Gaza, it turns out the government is losing diplomatic battles around the world, the latest being the UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire that the U.S. did not veto. By the way, part of this is due to the fact that there's an election coming this year in America, so the president is worried about losing the election, is responding to those people, particularly in the big states where there's a large Muslim population, is responding to them. Although his immediate response, as I said previously, was supportive of Israel. There's no doubt that the president's supportive of Israel. However, his support of Israel is overcome, if you will, by his desire to be reelected. And the the IDF's success in Gaza are not being translated into any kind of diplomatic success around the world. And that pretty much, I think, explains why the public gives high marks to the army and the general who stands at the head of the army, but not to the government and its prime minister. And the I think another reason why the Israeli army and the head of the army are doing better than the government in terms of public opinion is in terms of trust that have to do with accountability. The head of the army, Halevi, has said he takes full responsibility for the fiasco and is widely believed that he will step down after the war ends, whenever that is. So this is a tremendous importance in restoring public trust. Why? Because an institution can only rebuild trust it is seen to learn from its mistakes. And one way of demonstrating that the lessons are being learned is to replace those who were in charge when the mistakes were made. And the head of the army says he will step down when the fighting is over. In other words, he admits that he made a mistake, takes responsibility, and intends to resign. That gives people a lot of faith in him now while he's conducting the war. This sends a very powerful message that steps are being taken to correct the situation and people are taking responsibility. That's as far as the army is concerned. However, the same message is not being conveyed by the government, not by Netanyahu, the prime minister, who has only begrudgingly admitted any responsibility for what happened on October 7th and has signaled absolutely no intent to stepping down of his own volition anytime soon. And that, I think, really speaks poorly of the prime minister. He has not in any way hinted that he takes responsibility or that he will step down. That different mode of operation between the government and the army explains why people trust the army and its leader, and indeed the trust is rising according to the polls. While trust in the government and the head of the government is going in the opposite direction. Because the head of the army took responsibility, the head of the government has not taken responsibility. Then I think that speaks extremely well for the people in the army, the head of the army, speaks very poorly of Netanyahu. These are the facts on the ground right now. By the way, since I'm speaking about the leadership, I must say a word about the president, Isaac Herzog. An Israeli Democracy Index was published, and there is an increase in the public trust in the president since the start of the war in Gaza. In 2022, his confidence rating was 58% in June 2023, before the war. And at the height of the judicial overhaul debate, it fell to 54%. Now, after the war broke out, his approval rate rebounded and reached 61%. So, interesting, by the way, this index, the Israeli Democracy Index, also had an unexpected finding relating to Israeli Arabs' trust in the president. Israeli Arabs' trust in the president, which is generally quite low. In June 2023, only 18% of the Arabs trusted him. After October 7th, the figure doubled to 38%. Over the years, the presidency has generally been the national institution that enjoys the greatest confidence among Jewish citizens. After the army, certainly much higher than elected institutions like the Knesset and the government. What produced the rise in the president's confidence rating? That's a very interesting question, and I think I have an answer. Democracy Index shows that public trust in the IDF remains high, and the confidence in the president has increased since the start of the war. This indicates the extent to which Israeli public opinion is stable, even in the face of unprecedented traumatic events like October 7th. And the war that has ensued, there has been little change. A look at the data also shows just how strong is desire of Israeli Jews and even to some extent the Arab citizens to place the country above all partisan, ideological, sectoral, and tribal consideration. People yearn for words and deeds that express the public interest and the values that we all share. I'll be back after the break.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I wanted to say a few words about our neighbor Jordan, which you don't hear much about. We have a very, very long border with Jordan. It's peaceful. But it's interesting what's happening there now. The Jordanian authorities have accused the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas of seeking to destabilize Jordan. Behind Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, is the terrorist-sponsoring Emirate Qatar and its television bullhorn Al Jazeera. Jordan's leaders are doing exactly what many other Arab regimes have long been doing. They've been radicalizing their people and inciting them to violence against Israel. Why? As a means of distracting the people from the problems at home. The Arab leaders want their people to be busy hating Israel. Otherwise, the people might demand democracy and transparency and accountability from the corrupt Arab rulers. The Jordanian majesties, the king, queen, apparently seem to have gotten that if Israel were not protecting them, their own Palestinian population would have overthrown them or assassinated them long ago, because they did that to the king's grandfather, King Abdullah I. Actually, I said king's grandfather. I think he might have been his great-grandfather. Anyhow, the queen, her name is Rania, has apparently also forgotten that it's Hamas that is using its own citizens as human shields and stealing and hoarding the humanitarian aid and the hope that the blame will be assigned to Israel. According to Munaf al-Harbi, a Saudi Arabian political analyst, he wrote that it's no longer a secret that there are two parties that have interest in creating tension in the region and moving to a new front, the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran. They share the same agenda, which is destabilizing the Arab states. That's with the Muslim Brotherhood in Iran. Since the beginning of the Gaza war, we've seen that the Hamas leadership is trying to mobilize the Jordanian street and is trying to drag Jordanians into a war by any means. If Jordan's King Abdullah and his wife want to avoid chaos and a rather unpleasant outcome for themselves, they would do well to stop playing into the hands of the radical Islamists by inciting the Jordanian people to violence against Israel. Behind the incitement to violence that's empowering the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas in Jordan and pretty much destabilized the area lies the hand of Qatar. The Jordanian authorities have accused the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas of seeking to destabilize the Jordanian kingdom. The accusation by the Jordanian government came in the aftermath of recent demonstrations in the capital Amman and other parts of Jordan in support of Hamas and in condemnation of Israel. What are the demonstrators demanding? Demanding that Jordan shut down the Israeli embassy in Amman and cut all ties with Israel. Behind Hamas and behind the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, is the terrorist sponsoring Emirate Qatar and its propagandizing television Al Jazeera. The Jordan authorities and government officials do not seem to understand they are directly responsible for destabilizing their own security by continuously inciting against Israel. Since the beginning of the Hamas-Israel war in October, Jordanian leaders and government representatives have ramped up their anti-Israel rhetoric, paving the way for an outburst of protests. Reminding critics of Israel, war erupted after thousands of Hamas terrorists invaded Israel. So the Israeli victims, by the way, what happened on October 7th, U.S. President Joe Biden declared the attack to 15 9/11s. However, Jordan's leaders have yet to condemn Hamas for launching the war and committing crimes against women, children, and the elderly. Instead, King Abdullah, his wife Queen Rania, and Jordanian government officials are busy denouncing Israel for daring to go to war to defend its citizens against the terrorists in the Gaza Strip. Jordan's leaders are doing exactly what many other Arab regimes have long been doing. They are radicalizing their people, inciting them to violence against Israel. Why? As a means of distracting them from problems at home. The Arab leaders really want their people to be busy hating Israel. Otherwise, their people might demand democracy, transparency, and accountability from their corrupt Arab rulers. That's why many Arab leaders and their governments continue to unleash campaigns against Israel by accusing it of genocide and war crimes, of all things. However, as I understand it, it is precisely this anti-Israel rhetoric that drives Arabs and Muslims into the arms of Muslim terrorist groups such as Hamas and the Islamic State. It's also this type of rhetoric that prompts thousands of Jordanians to take to the streets to chant slogans in support of Hamas and to repeat the same libels and falsehoods against Israel. Jordanian officials have no right to complain that Islamist terrorist groups are seeking to undermine security and stability in Jordan. The demonstrations outside the Israeli embassy in Amman, the capital, and the slogans in support of Hamas are the direct result of the anti-Israel campaign of incitement to violence by Jordanian leaders. These pro-Hamas and anti-Israel protesters who are demonstrating on the streets of Amman have undoubtedly been listening to the statements made by their leaders since the beginning of this war. The message the demonstrators are sending to Jordan's leaders is, you have been telling us that Israel is so evil. How can you justify not severing Jordan's diplomatic relations with Israel if Israel is so evil? So instead of holding Hamas responsible for initiating the war, Queen Rani has been serving as an apologist for the terrorist group, engaging in vitriolic verbal attacks on Israel, their Jordanian majesties, the king and the queen, apparently seem to have forgotten that if Israel were not protecting them, their own Palestinian population would have overthrown them or assassinated them long ago, as they did to the king's grandfather, Abdullah I. So, the Queen Rania was born in Kuwait to Palestinian parents, and she accuses Israel of hoarding humanitarian aid. And she signs this blame to Israel. She went so far as equating what happened on October 17th to Israel's counterterrorism measures. She said, and I quote, "I would say that as devastating and as traumatic as October 7th was, it doesn't give Israel license to commit atrocity after atrocity. Israel experienced one on October 7th. Since then, the Palestinians have experienced 156 October 7s. She said it's on the 156th day of the war, of course. And also, the king, Abdullah, has been engaging in anti-Israel rhetoric since October 7th. His foreign affairs minister, a guy named Safadi, has accused Israel of war crimes and starvation of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, when it's actually been Hamas starving the Arabs in the Gaza Strip. They also accuse Jews who peacefully visit the Temple Mount in Jerusalem of storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's important to note that Jewish visitors do not set foot inside the mosque during their approved routine visits to the outdoor Temple Mount compound. This, however, has not stopped Jordan's leaders from continuing to level force charges against Israel, including the claim that Jews are violently invading the mosque, which is absolutely a lie. So it's no wonder, then, that thousands of people in Jordan take to the streets to chant slogans in support of Hamas and try to storm the Israeli embassy in Amman. What are Jordanians supposed to do when they hear their leaders demonize Israel and make false accusations against Israel? Are they expected to sit at home and do nothing? Of course not. That's why they have been taking to the streets every single day to praise Hamas and call for rescinding the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan. Jordanian sources who spoke to a London-based Pan-Arab newspaper called Asharik al-Awsat accused the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas of working together to involve the Jordanian street in the Battle of Gaza and push Jordanian street towards escalation against the Jordanian government. And this newspaper, when it was referring to clashes between demonstrators and security forces, this newspaper in Arabic quoted unnamed sources as saying the escalation of chaos and violence that Jordan is witnessing these days constitute a prelude to a conspiracy led by the Muslim Brotherhood with clear Iranian goals to recreate chaos in the system. The Muslim Brotherhood and Iran are exploiting the issue of the war in the Gaza Strip to mobilize the Jordanian street against the king, the army, and the government. A Saudi political analysis said, "It's no longer a secret there are two parties that have interest in creating tension in the region and moving to a new front. These two parties are the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran. They share the same goals." And the Jordanian monarch, I think, has to be reminded how his late father, King Hussein, cracked down on the Palestinian terrorists back in the early 1970s. I remember that well. Then, at that time in 1970, King Hussein's security forces killed thousands of Palestinians after they tried to create a state within a state inside the kingdom, and an armed conflict between the Jordanian army and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. They call it Black September. I remember that because literally thousands of Palestinians ran away from the Jordanian army by going across the Jordan River into Israel to escape the Jordanian army. So if King Abdullah II doesn't stop appeasing Palestinian terrorists, it's only a matter of time, I believe, before they join up against him and they try to end his reign. If that happens, even Israel will not be able to save him as they did in 1970. So I think it's about time, and I'm no big political analyst, it's about time for the Arab leaders to realize that by endlessly doing anti-Israel rhetoric, they're shooting themselves in the foot. The pro-Hamas demonstrators on the streets of Jordan not only want to eliminate Israel and kill Jews, they also want to see the king and his family removed from power. The demonstrators in Jordan consider the king and queen traitors. Why? Because they maintain a peace treaty with Israel. If Jordan's King Abdullah and his wife want to avoid chaos in Jordan and a rather unpleasant outcome for themselves, they would do well to stop playing into the hands of the radical Islamists by inciting the Jordanian people against Israel. However, behind the incitement to violence, it's empowering the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas and destabilizing the area, apparently lies the hand of Qatar. Qatar is playing both sides of the street. So far, very cleverly. They're also being used now to find to get our hostages released. And Qatar is a very small country, sits on a fountain of oil, and they know how to play their politics with the East and with the West to keep themselves safe. That they're also a basis for a lot of violence by organizations at their home bases there, and they act against other countries. So Qatar is a country that has to be watched. And I'm no big political analyst, but see, some things are extremely obvious. I want to close this part of the program with a footnote. A picture from the Iranian city of Hamadan went viral, showing a Palestinian flag hung defiantly right at the entrance to the shrine where, according to Jewish tradition, the graves of the heroes of the Book of Esther, Queen Esther and Mordecai, are believed to be. A flag found by the chief rabbi of Iran took him by surprise. The shrine has served as a place of Jewish pilgrimage, has been vandalized and obstructive in the past, and there's been arson against it and demonstrations and signs that to Israel. In a country, Iran, where the right of peaceful assembly is rarely honored unless aligned with or not ordered by the regime, these demonstrations are even more meaningful. So here in this city, where Esther and Mordechai are buried, there are attacks against their tombs because of the present situation. That's what's happening in Iran. I'll be back after the break.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel? Shalom, I'm Natalie Sapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home.
Every Sunday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Straight talk from Israel. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
In this segment of the program, I want to discuss several separate items. They're not related to each other, but I think they should be of interest to the listeners. First of all, the United Nations Security Council president last Monday referred to the Palestinian Authority's application to become a full member of the world body. He referred it to a committee for the admission of new members. So what you have is that the Palestinian Authority, which in a sense doesn't exist any, it doesn't have a country that it rules, and they've applied to become a member of the UN, just like any other normal country. And when I say normal country, I mean they have a government, they have a border, etc. I think the listeners know what I mean by a normal company. So this Palestinian Authority, which is not a normal country, has applied to the UN for membership, and the UN is considering it. The ambassador to the UN from Malta proposed that the committee meet on next Monday afternoon to consider the application, adding that deliberation has to take place this month. It turns out that Malta is president of the Security Council for April. What happened is that the Palestinian Authority last week formally asked for renewed consideration by the United Nations Security Council of its application that it put in back in 2011 to become a full member of the world body. In other words, they put in an application 13 years ago to become a member. The Palestinians are a non-member observer state at the United Nations, which, by the way, is the same status as the Vatican City. So the committee of the 15 members first assesses an application to see if it satisfies requirements for UN membership. The application can either be shelved or put forward for a formal vote in the Security Council. And approval requires at least 9 votes in favor and no vetoes by the United States, Russia, China, France, or Britain. So here you have this non-existent country, the Palestinian Authority, putting in application for membership back in 2011, is now being considered by the UN. So that's interesting. This non-existing country is being serious consideration for becoming a member of the UN. That says something about the UN. It's something rather negative, I think. The next item has to do with Rutgers University. I attended graduate school at Rutgers University, so anytime I see Rutgers University mentioned, I'm sort of interested. I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, but I did graduate work at Rutgers University. Now, it turns out that Rutgers University President Jonathan Holloway and Jewish students were forced to flee a Rutgers University student assembly town hall after pro-Palestinian students disrupted and hijacked a meeting with pro-terrorism and anti-Israel chants. See, the town hall came after the president, Holloway, had issued a statement about a March 7th boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement referendum being voted on by the student government. So why a student government is worried about DDS is something I don't know, but apparently this is what's happening. So he, the president, Holloway, issued a statement last Monday as the results were uncertain, and he condemned BDS, and he was in favor of support of academic cooperation with Israeli institutions. It turns out that the Rutgers University has a number of things going on in Israel, and this referendum that they put in there called to divert from businesses doing business with Israel and to terminate the partnership with Tel Aviv University. So the president of Rutgers attempted to explain during the town hall meeting that he refused to stop the vote from happening and didn't want to interfere, but he felt that he needed to comment because of the harassment and tensions on campus. So he said, the president of Rutgers University said, "I think the BDS is wrong. I believe in engagement, not isolation. I believe that enlightenment comes from involvement, and that lasting progress and peace are the outcomes of diplomacy and discussion. Our partnership with Tel Aviv University adds to our fundamental academic and research mission." So the president of Rutgers says cooperating with Tel Aviv University is a good thing academically. So when Holloway, the president of the university, came on the stage, he was booed by the pro-Palestinian student activists. And an initial discussion between him and the student assembly president had to be ended early due to constant interruption by protesters when the organizers attempted to shift to the question and answer period. Activists continued to heckle, mock, and verbally abuse Holloway. In other words, pro-Palestinian students on campus heckled, mocked, and verbally assaulted the president of the university. They accused him of supporting genocide. Eventually, the university president had to be escorted out of the hall by police and security. And pro-Palestinian activists continued to chant slogans after he departed. They shouted things like, "We don't want two states, we want 48. There's one solution, Intifada. Long live the Intifada. Settlers go back home. Palestine is ours alone. Jerusalem is our capital from the river to the sea. Holloway is a Zionist. All Zionists are racist." They called for a violent uprising. And it turns out that the president of Rutgers University was driven out of a meeting by pro-Palestinian students. That is what is happening in the United States. It was a very small item in the newspaper, but I think it's extremely important. The very fact that pro-Palestinians can drive the president of a university out of a meeting with their pro-Palestinian shouts, and the fact that the police don't arrest them, instead that they escort the president out, I said something very bad is happening in academia in the United States. I saw an article by a writer named Micha Halpern. And he wrote an article I found very interesting. I want to share what he said with the listeners. He said that most Americans don't really care about Israel, about the Palestinians, or the Middle East in general. They probably couldn't find Gaza on the globe. And it's not an exaggeration. Most Americans don't really care about anything that doesn't directly involve them. So not caring about Israel and the Middle East is par for the course. Americans are consumed by just a lack of interest. It's not a modern American malady. As far back as 1979, the president, Jimmy Carter, said that there was a moral and economic crisis. There's a crisis of economics and of spirit. Americans simply do not care. Judging by the media coverage, one might think that support for Israel is eroding. The truth is, interest is eroding only with the few who care enough to pay attention to begin with to world events. When watching the media, we don't take into account the masses who from the start never really cared. The masses, we're talking about Americans, true of probably other countries, the masses are simply not interested, not only in Israel, but in every other issue as well. Americans suffer from a lack of interest. They suffer from a general sense of not caring. They get excited perhaps about sports or music or books or movies. And as an example, Micha Halpern points out there's a war right now going on between Russia and Ukraine. It is now a back burner issue. Nobody really cares about to the average American. You stop people on the street and you will learn that an astounding number of people don't even realize that the war between Russia and Ukraine is still going on. Many people, especially the young people, get their news from comedy shows. Once upon a time, there were late night comedy shows. And they were watched live. There were fewer television stations also. You were forced to watch a few limited number of stations. Today, they're watched at the convenience of the watcher on YouTube or X. There is no immediacy anymore. Fast forwarding provides the ability to skip segments that are not relevant to the life of the viewer. New information simply doesn't reach their consciences. Now, there are, of course, people who support Israel. There are those who care, who read every report that comes out, who watch every news program, those who seek out websites and briefings, and they search for coverage that doesn't vilify Israel. They are the people who are involved. They try to push back against the lies and different disinformation that are so being spread, but they are in the minority. And then, of course, there are people who are doing it the opposite. There are people who are spreading the lies. These are Israel's detractors. They are the second group of people who care, who really intensely, vocally, and very misguidedly care. These detractors of Israel are emotionally committed to portraying Israel and Jews in the most evil light. Truth and facts are not important to them. They hang posters proclaiming rape is resistance, babies are occupiers, and things like that. They are driven by a nearly medieval sense of Jew hatred, far deeper than modern anti-Semitism. But most Americans are simply in the middle. They don't really care much about anything, not just about Israel. They simply don't care about anything. They not only do not know where Gaza is, They do not know what Hamas stands for. or what is important to Hamas. If you told them, they would probably listen, just as you listen to the detractors. And their takeaway would be that a keffiyeh makes a very attractive scarf. Most people, I'm talking about the Americans, most people simply do not care. When people stop caring, they stop caring about everything. Right and wrong, evil, justice, they're just words. Dialogue and decisions become relevant or totally irrelevant. Converting an Israeli detractor from a hater of Jews and a hater of Israel into a lover of Jews or a defender of Jews in Israel is nearly impossible. That's the bottom line. So it should not be the goal to get people to defend Israel. The challenge is not how to transform detractors and supporters, but the challenge is how to get the masses of Americans who couldn't care less about anything to care about something. That something, as far as we're concerned, is Israel. Deep inside, most Americans know that hating Jews, burning, murdering, and massacring Jews, and then embracing their murderers is wrong. Most people know that. The challenge is to get them to care. It's worth the effort, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work. There's no reason to despair. With or without apathetic Americans, Israel will survive. We in Israel are responsible for our own future. And if most Americans don't care, that is not really our problem. We have to see to it that the Jewish people care and support us, and then do whatever they can politically to support us. At the beginning of this segment of the program, I spoke about Rutgers University. The Jewish student in general, in the university campuses, Jewish students are being openly excluded from campuses. They're targeted for violence and harassment, and they're forced either to fight back or endure some of those obscene instances of demonization of Jews. This is in America now. It's the worst that it's been since Nazi Germany. That's what happened in the United States now. Now, interestingly enough, there are laws on the books in the United States. The laws, they're known as the KKK laws, are used to combat everything from police brutality and election interference. Or infringing on access to America has laws to protect people. Problem is that while the United States Department of Justice has no problem enforcing these laws against individuals and groups that they oppose, like pro-life protesters, they have steadfastly refused to enforce the laws to protect Jewish students who are under the most widespread anti-Semitic assaults that the United States has ever seen. Hopefully, this will soon change. The United States is a nation of law, reinforced by the rule of law. Yet, Jewish students are being abandoned by the system and suffering something far worse than being called by the wrong pronoun. Right now, they're trying to protect Jewish students in the United States. Only the Department of Justice can enforce laws meant to ensure that all Americans can exercise their constitutional and federally protected rights. The ball is now in the court of the Attorney General and the entire Biden administration. So we can only hope that Congress will call that the Justice Department enforce existing civil rights laws and make sure that Jews, Jewish students, and Jews everywhere are protected. Until next time, this is Jay Shapiro signing off. Thanks for listening.
Shalom, this is Nadia Matar from the Sovereignty Movement. At a time when there is so much disinformation, you have to know who to listen to know what really is going on in Israel. Israel News Talk Radio is the radio where you can know that what you hear is the truth.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.